go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Boland. Scott, we have sort of a racing episode today.
Yeah, we do. No, this is. I'll say this is a racing episode.
This is a legit racing episode?
Why not? We're going to go back to our Automotive Mysteries, Myths, Rumors Revealed book that, you know, we had mentioned in the last, I think it was very recently we had an episode about that. And we've got another legend that I think people might be interested in. You know, is it true or is it false?
And yes.
I don't know, this one really has captured my attention immediately when I opened the table of contents. And it's about, there's a legend that a monkey named Jocko Flacco won as many NASCAR Grand National races as Mario Andretti, Buddy Schumann, and Mark Donahue.
And I know a lot of people right now are saying, come on, guys, no way. But let's be specific, it was a rhesus monkey. And they're pretty good at driving.
Not bad. Not a bad way to say it. And, you know, you got to remember, Mario Andretti, Buddy Schumann, and Mark Donahue have won one Grand National race. Is that right?
Yeah.
So that's – I guess that could be true, right? I mean, this story, it begs us to dig a little further, right? I mean, we should explain what we're talking about here, because I think a lot of people are going to say there was a – I don't get it. There's a monkey driving a NASCAR – race car?
Right.
And he won a race?
Yeah.
How does that all work?
It's weird. So maybe one of the first things we should talk about when we explain this is the time period, right, man?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, because, you know, we have to go way, way back in NASCAR history because, as you know, it was much, much different when it was founded back in, like, the
1948.
Yeah, 48. Bill France, right?
Mm-hmm.
The France family that still owns NASCAR. And it was much, much different then than it was now. A lot more, I guess you could say a lot more was able to fly at that point.
Yeah, it wasn't quite as formalized.
Yeah.
And that's an understatement. It was nowhere near as formalized.
Now, Ben, I've got an opinion about this. Now, NASCAR to me, now there's a lot of crazy stuff that happens in NASCAR, and it seems like there's always, you know, fighting going on. There's drama. It's almost like it's like a weekly soap opera at some points, really, with all the drama and activity that happens, you know, surrounding the race and the race itself.
And the debatable gray areas of getting around regulations.
But I do want to say that it's also extremely regimented in the rules, in that, you know, there's rules about everything in NASCAR today.
Yes.
And back then in the 1940s, 1950s, those rules didn't exist. But now, I mean, they've got rules about fighting. They got rules about if you say something bad about a sponsor in a press interview, you get fined for that. They have rules about the way the pit crew stands at attention during the national anthem.
Yeah. So what we're saying is that the rules for NASCAR, modern NASCAR, do not just apply to the vehicle. They apply to everything you could imagine about the vehicles, the crews, the just the staff at the venues.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, that they've got, you know, this idea, the standard that they want to uphold, and they want to have, you know, a certain image, and they try very hard to maintain that image. And, you know, there's these occurrences, these happenings that go on outside that, you know, some people say that maybe some of that's a put on. Some of that's like for additional publicity.
Oh, you know, like that, wrestling or rappers?
Yeah, kind of like that. You know, and some people have gone so far as to say that race outcomes are decided like that. And I'm not going to point any fingers or say anything, but they say that it's almost a scripted event completely from start to finish.
Oh, Scott, you're verging on conspiracy.
I don't buy into it myself personally, the race bit.
I don't either.
But I do know that they're very controlling as far as, you know, what they allow in the cars, what they allow around the cars, the shapes of the cars themselves, the way the crew behaves when they're outside of a venue, the way the crew behaves inside the venue. You know, it's just very, very regimented, very, very strict. And that was not the case back, if you want to go back to, let's just say, oh, I don't know, how about the early 1950s?
Excellent choice, sir.
Oh, thank you.
Now, when you say the early 1950s, that reminds me of a driver that we should talk about.
Okay, who is that?
act surprised, Julius Timothy Flock, better known as Tim.
Yeah, and his brothers, right?
Yeah, yeah, the Flock Bros.
Yeah, Bob and Fonty were his other brothers, and they also had a sister named Ethel who also competed. She raced in something like more than 100 races in her day as well.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys, these were... Well, Bob and Fonty, anyways, they were moonshine runners, which fit the NASCAR demographic of the day right to a T, right? Because we've talked about that.
That's what I was – you know what? Just a quick sidebar.
Yeah.
I promise I won't do a lot of sidebars in this episode.
Okay, me
but
either.
When I'm talking to people about NASCAR, and you know sometimes there are people who will be a little bit – I don't want to say stuck up. But I'm going to say stuck up about it, you know. Why would they're racing in a circle or whatever? Those people, and I'm glad they have their opinions, but they need to do their research because they don't understand how cool and kind of outlaw NASCAR was in the very beginning. So when we say these are moonshine runners, for anybody who wants to hear the full story, please do check out our earlier podcast on the origins of NASCAR.
You know, I totally agree with you. There's some people that are a little bit irreverent about it, and you say, you know, where did this series come from? These were daredevils. These were moonshiners. These were guys that had some serious driving skills, and they had honed them in these, you know, in the woods and the hollers, you know, in the South, running from the law in these amazing hot rod vehicles that were really, really heavily modified to hold all that moonshine weight and all the extra, you know, well, just the baggage that goes along with that. I mean, you know, the fear of going to jail for the rest of your life or for a long period of time, probably, that's what kept them driving fast, and that's what made them the champions that they were, right?
And
so, it was just an interesting series right from the beginning.
And one more thing before I end my rant and get off the soapbox, a lot of the safety equipment that keeps people alive today, non-racers alive today in traffic, came directly from racing.
Yeah, that's right, and a lot of it from NASCAR racing. So, you know, there's a good bit of this that is relevant to us even now.
Yes, I apologize. I'm stepping off my soapbox.
All right, so we're talking Flock about brothers. The Flock brothers. We're talking about Bob, Fonty, and of course Tim and their sister Ethel.
Yep.
Now the Fonty brothers. Now Bob and Fonty, they were moonshine runners for their the guy that they called their uncle. I don't know if it truly was their uncle or not, but the guy's name was Peachtree Williams, and he was an Atlanta corn liquor tycoon. So you knew that he was one of the guys that we were just mentioning right there, right?
Based on his job description, he's my favorite person in this story.
The favorite character in the whole thing for you, huh?
Corn liquor tycoon?
Corn liquor tycoon, yeah.
Put that on my business
card. That's not bad. So, anyways, Fonty was a very good driver, I guess. Fonty was probably the best of all of them, as a matter of fact, right when they first started.
Yes.
And in fact, he won a NASCAR pre-NASCAR championship before the series formed. And then in 1951, he placed second in the Grand National title hunt. So he was really talented, Fonty was. But out of all three of them, Tim Flock actually became the most successful overall, you know, after all this plays out, as you'll hear.
Tim Flock won. He's a two-time NASCAR Grand National Champion winner. That's 52 and 55. 40 over the course of his career, 40 Grand National wins, 38 Grand National poles. He is the only driver to win in every NASCAR division on Daytona Beach. So,
now, you know what? You just said on Daytona Beach.
Yes,
I did. That's interesting because we're talking about the sand course.
Yes.
Right? This is when they raced on the beach. So he won in every single series on the sand in those giant cars. Can you imagine that?
Yep.
That's a talented driver.
I mean, this guy is the business
now,
when it comes to racing.
Okay, so you mentioned 1952 championship, 1955 championship.
Yep.
Okay, there was a period of time in between. Actually, you got to go back to the beginning just a year before that to start it, but the interesting part that we're going to get to happens in 1953. So that's just a little sneak of what's happening. But now Tim himself, he was not a mechanical person. He's really, really poor. So as were a lot of the early NASCAR drivers, they were just looking for a ride, right?
Absolutely.
So they're shopping around for somebody that can provide a race car for them to drive in these NASCAR events. And that, to some extent, that still happens today. There are drivers out there that are looking for a ride even now.
Well, let's call
in
it
every series.
An early form of sponsorship.
Yeah, sure. That's what it was. It was very early because Tim came across Ted Chester,
yes,
who was an Atlanta car dealer, mm-hmm. and I guess he was a big race fan and a big, you know, early days of NASCAR fan, stock car fan.
Yeah.
And the two became friends kind of quickly, and Chester, you know, said, well, this is going to work out perfect for me because I can sponsor a car. I can give you a ride.
Mm-hmm.
You can, you know, put my name all over it and go out there and do your thing because
people come to Ted Chester's auto.
Yeah, exactly. I know you've got talent, so let's see it. Let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. And he bought him an old 88 that they called the Black Phantom.
Yes.
And well, Bob's brother, by the way, or his brother, I'm sorry, Tim's. Boy, Tim's brother Bob, his car was named the Grey Ghost. So it was kind of like, you know, the Grey Ghost and the Black Phantom, the two brothers racing, you know, different teams. But anyways, Ted Chester and this old 88 and the Black Phantom and Tim Flock, you know, they're all one there for the 1951 season. And actually, it was a pretty successful season for him. I mean, he won seven races that year,
yep.
and he came in third in the championship. And his brother Fonte, by the way, who was still racing, came in second in the championship that year. So this was like the era of the Flock brothers, right?
Right. Now, of course, this wasn't the best year for the youngest Flock brother in 53.
No, not at all.
And Ted Chester, what I like about his jib, the cut of his jib here, is that Ted Chester is a man with vision, you know?
Yeah, he did. He had great vision. That's right. And, you know, this is after they did have another season in between where Tim also won eight races in a Hudson Hornet.
Yes.
That they had sold that Olds 88 for. So, and the Grand National title in 52.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time we get to 53, and you mentioned that Ted, he's this visionary. He's got a plan. He's got to figure out a way to gin up some excitement because the start of the 53 season was not great for Tim. And,
yeah.
You know, he had some kind of low ranking starts there at the beginning.
Yeah.
And, I don't even know if he may have not have finished a couple races, but, anyways, this Atlanta car dealer, this Chester mm-hmm. guy, he's quite a showman.
Right. And he's saying, because, you know, he's a salesman, he's a showman. So he knows that one of the biggest things, you need when you want popularity is to have, something different, something unique, something unorthodox.
You need a gimmick.
You
right?
need a shtick.
A gimmick. And
yeah.
So he's wandering around. This is such a strange story. He's wandering around in Atlanta.
He's just in downtown Atlanta.
Yeah, this guy's wandering around. He goes into a pet shop.
Uh-huh.
And he sees a rhesus monkey. And
yep.
this rhesus monkey is in a cage. And the cage says that his name on the cage, it says that this monkey's name is Jocko.
And then Ted Chester, for some reason, has this moment of clarity, this epiphany, where he thinks, I'll name the monkey Jocko Flocko, and I'll give it to Tim, and he'll race with it.
This is so crazy. this is a truly crazy thought. He's like mumbling the name of the monkey. He's like, Jocko. What's that
Jocko,
rhyme with Flock?
Jocko Flocko.
That's it. I'm going to go with Jocko Flocko, and he's going to race with my NASCAR driver.
He's going to ride shotgun.
He's going to be his co-driver. How cool is that going to be, right?
Yeah.
And he says, that's it. I'm gonna do it. And so he buys the monkey right on the scene. He buys it right then at that moment.
Shows up to Ted Flock's house.
Yeah, he went to the garage where
the car was being
worked on in some garage somewhere in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And he goes there and he springs this idea on him right in front of the mechanic.
Yeah. Tim is not a fan initially.
No.
He thinks that Ted is drunk.
You know what? I probably would have thought the same thing. I think I would have. I mean, what are you talking about? You're going to have a monkey race in my car with me? Is he going to, you know, he's going to actually drive for a stint or what?
But let's not forget, again, that Ted Chester is a salesman. So he manages to sell Tim Flock on the idea. And so the more they talk about it and the more Tim thinks about it, the more he's thinking, yeah, okay.
Okay, there's a little bit of insight on this.
Oh, now, you got some insider
info? Now, the reason, not really, it's from the article here, so it's not terribly new info to you, but Tim Flock, he was kind of, he went with this for this one, maybe for this reason, because I guess his family has kind of a history of this
yeah.
kind of crazy, you know, like a self-promotion idea. It turns out that one of his older sisters was in an air show as a wing walker and a stunt parachuter. Now, that's kind of strange. I mean, for a female to be doing that, especially in the
that
early
day and age.
In the early 1950s, rather.
Mm-hmm.
And Fonte, I love this description. Fonte, who they called a debonair raconteur, sometimes raced in shorts and was the greatest showman of his era. So he's in a NASCAR race racing in shorts. Can you believe that?
A raconteur, by the way, is another word essentially for storyteller.
Yeah, yeah. He's like a grand storyteller. He's very debonair in that he could persuade people easily and that, you know, this is
silver tongue.
So for Tim to say, you know what? You know what, Chester, I say we go with it. Let's do this and see what happens. And the idea is that they know that NASCAR probably won't allow this to happen. You know, the France family, they've already got like a pretty tight grip on the series, and they've got, and I guess Flock and France had some kind of words about some other issues in the past. And, you know,
right.
So they weren't on great terms to begin with. And I can imagine that, you know, France would have said, I don't know if this is really going to be the best for NASCAR's new image at the time. You know,
that's absolutely what they said, because they want to get they're building their rep at this era. You know, so they don't want this to be something where it turns into a race where like every driver has their little animal sidekick.
Yeah.
Of course, they would say no, and that's why these men realize that this is a situation where perhaps it's better to ask for forgiveness rather than to ask for permission.
That's right. And you know what? My whole life is based on this aspect of life, that you ask for forgiveness rather than permission. I do this often.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I really do. I have in the past. I'm not so much now. I'm a little more settled down now. But hey, you know what? One quick sidebar.
Yeah.
Maybe this is the last one. Maybe.
Okay.
But do you recall, you know, we talked about Donald Campbell recently, and he had Mr. Wopat that rode with him as his co-pilot, right?
Yep.
And that was a little bear, it wasn't a real bear, but it was a
bear. Stuffed animal.
Do you remember way, way back when we talked about race cars in 2025?
Yes.
Okay. There was an entry from BMW where they, the BMW entry, they decided that the co-pilot for their entry was going to be a goldfish. Do you remember that? And not that it's going to do anything.
I do remember that.
But the goldfish was part of the design of the vehicle.
And that was one of our very first podcasts.
Anyways, I'm drawing some kind of
parallels.
Some type of parallel here. But okay.
Yeah, so it's not going to fly.
Back to 1953.
Jaco Flacco, they know the Franz family is not going to give them permission.
They didn't even ask.
So they didn't ask.
Didn't even ask.
So what they did was they just said, okay, start building a special monkey-proof seat. I mean, essentially, that's what they said.
This is crazy.
Yeah, and start building that, and make sure that the monkey is not going to get in trouble, and then we'll wait until moments before the race begins, and we'll bring Jaco out. So they manage to successfully install the seat for Jaco on the passenger side, and they make sure that it's high enough that Jaco can see and be seen.
Yeah, that's
in
the important
window. That's the key part here.
That's the important part. And there's a little bit of dispute as to whether this was an actual seat or if it was a perch,
right?
Or if it was a cage, because there's
all three.
There's three different versions of this, and that, I would like to believe. I want so badly to believe that he had a little racing seat that he sat in. I don't know why. I just think it's a better image.
Yeah, it is a better image. I don't know if it's the most plausible.
No, probably not.
But he did have a racing uniform. I forgot to mention that part. Because
he did.
Because while they're putting a Reese's monkey, which, you know, they're smaller animals, while they're putting this specially designed seat in, and while they're really going to race with this primate, they decide that safety is an issue.
Ugh.
So they give it a racing uniform and a little monkey helmet.
See, more promotion. That's what this is.
Yeah.
So, okay, one other interesting little fact here is that the debut of Jaco Flacco was at Charlotte Speedway.
Yep.
This is not the current Charlotte Motor Speedway that's in Concord. In fact, the current Motor Speedway was built sometime later by Curtis Turner, who was the guy that we talked about in one of our Audible moments or mentions, I guess. The guy that drove for Smokey Eunuch, in that crazy small Chevelle.
Yes.
So anyways, okay, there's a lot of tie-ins in this series here. So, okay, so.
So it's a 150 lap race, the very first race there in Charlotte. And, Tim Flock is in the lead seven times, 87 laps. He loses power partway through the race, so that the win goes to, the driver Dick Passwater, and Flock manages to finish fourth. Now, at that point in that race, he gets about $350 finishing fourth.
That's an unfortunate name for another driver.
Dick Passwater is.
Yeah, yeah. I know. You know, Ben,
I mean, call yourself Richard, buddy.
I've returned back to a 7-year-old's mentality here, but I know, but it makes me laugh every time I hear it. Okay, so yeah. He finished fourth that day, right? And
right.
So it wasn't this maiden voyage of Jocko Flacco wasn't a success for Tim as a driver,
but as a brand.
Yes.
As a brand, people in the stands and, of course, other drivers notice that he's not alone in the vehicle.
During the race.
Right.
And it freaks them out. He said they almost hit the guardrails and when they saw it and they spotted it, because, you know, no one had any idea that he was going to do this other than his own team and his family.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the surprise of seeing a Reese's monkey in a racing suit in the car next to you as you're driving at, you know, 100 plus miles an hour, that's got to be kind of shocking.
And the fans go wild after the race. So picture, if you will, the first, second, and third place drivers watching all of the fans run to see this guy's monkey.
Yeah.
So he becomes this overnight NASCAR star.
He's a media sensation, a fan sensation.
Right. So what does the Franz family do?
They
then
decide that they're going to allow it. They say like, this is,
you
know what? That's fine. If you want to do this, cause it's bringing people in. It's the major draw for the 1953 season is Jocko Flacco. And this is crazy. I mean, because come on, he's got a live monkey in the seat next to him when he's trying to focus on what he's doing. I mean, he's a professional driver.
And the calculation that NASCAR has here is pretty good, pretty smart, I think.
It was spot on.
Because they said, okay, now let's keep in mind that this is in the earlier days, so the Grand National Tour is nowhere near as established. So it's good for publicity. It also sells tickets.
That's right. And he's the only one to do it. It's not like anybody else, you know, copied him and did the same thing. But, you know, they actually went as far as to label the car with Jocko Flacco over top of the passenger's door, because that was his seat, you know.
Yeah.
It was a big deal at the time, and kids would, you know, they'd take the monkey up into the stand area, and the kids would feed it peanuts in between races, and it was just it was kind of a neat thing that happened from this. It all spawned this Jocko Flacco mania, I guess, in that 1 year in that series. It was really kind of neat.
And anecdotal evidence indicates that Jocko was leading a pretty good life.
Yeah.
He wasn't mistreated. I think it's important to note that. Of course, you know, riding shotgun in a race car is not a rhesus monkey's natural environment.
No.
Sure. And that does come into play later. But I think it's very important here to note that that Jocko Flacco also lived with his driver, right?
Yeah, he lived with Tim Flock and his family
and his kids
in Atlanta.
Yeah,
and had in a comfortable home in the backyard. That's where he lived, in a cage or something, whatever setup they had for him there. He played with the kids on the swing set.
Yeah, so he wasn't abused.
They'd take him on walks. No, they would take him on walks with like with a leash, and it was like a family pet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he just happened to race with Dad in NASCAR on the weekend. That's all.
Yeah, and he raced more than once.
Many times. Yeah.
Yeah, he had many races. Probably what's remembered as one of the high points of his career, right?
Mm-hmm.
May 16th, 1953.
Ah, yes. I've got it May 15th, but May 16th may have been the date. Mm-hmm. It was mid-May anyways. Let's say mid-May, because I'm not sure on the exact date of the race. But mid-May 1953, that was the big day. That was the win, right? That's what he actually – this is the day that Tim Flock won. It was at
Hickory Speedway.
Hickory Speedway. That was in North Carolina. And it was pretty tremendous. I mean, because there's Jocko Flacco in the winner's circle with Tim Flock. And, of course,
National.
You know, Tim thought, well, this is my luck turning around. You know, he's, I guess, superstitious. Who knows?
Yeah.
Most drivers really are.
Sure.
But anyways, it was a big deal for the two of them to be in Winner's Circle together. And that's where we get this, this legend that we're talking about. Because, mm-hmm. if you carefully listen to what we said, he won as many NASCAR Grand National races as Mario Andretti, Buddy Schumann, and Mark Donahue.
All of whom won. One.
Exactly, one race. So he's tied their record in a way as a co-driver, I guess.
Yeah, we're parsing this pretty quick. Pretty thoroughly, but the devil is in the detail here. The good news is that Flock and Flacco, which I think would make a great buddy cop movie, they get a cool grand for their winnings.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's so that gives you an idea of the prize money of the day compared to the $1 million payouts
right
of now.
Flacco gets peanuts.
Yeah, and as he said, that monkey got the best of bananas at home too. So, he said that he was very well taken care of, and I'm sure after the win, there was a little something extra in his bowl for that, I'm sure. So,
and
okay.
Now
it was a little bit downhill after that, right?
Yeah, because can we have some downhill music, like some stories taking a turn.
Yeah, it is. It's taking a turn, but something like this is bound to happen, and it's probably not going to end. When I say this, you're not going to understand what exactly happened. I mean, there's a twist to it.
Sure.
There was a disaster that happened at Raleigh Speedway in North Carolina mm-hmm. shortly after that. So this is in 1953. The entire year wasn't a good year for the two of them.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, just to give you an idea of how early on in the series this was.
Yeah.
This was, the Raleigh Speedway track in North Carolina was one of only two paved NASCAR tracks of that era in the Grand National Circuit.
I'm so glad you said that. Yeah, just Raleigh and, Darlington.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, so you knew the other one. And the other thing is that it was a 300-mile race that happened on that day in Raleigh. And it took about 4 hours to complete that thing. And I looked up the time to complete the 2013 Daytona 500.
Yeah.
So 200 additional miles, mm-hmm. Different type of track, I guess. But it takes them about 3 hours and 10 minutes now to finish the same, or actually a longer race. So, the speeds are not quite what they were now, but they're mm-hmm. still, I'll tell you, that's still pretty wickedly fast for those kinds of vehicles back then.
Heck yes. And it becomes it's fast enough where it might be a safety issue to have an animal in the vehicle with
yeah,
you.
A huge safety issue. So there's this whole, I guess, a series of events that happens on the day of this tragedy.
Right. And this is Memorial Day weekend.
And I said it's not exactly what you might think because we mentioned that it's a long race, right?
Yep.
And it gave Jocko plenty of time to, quote, get loose in the cockpit. Mm-hmm. Sometime within that 4 hours. Now, can you imagine that, first of all? He's secured for most of the time.
Right.
Waving to the fans, waving to the, other people. Mm-hmm. And that's what he did. He waved to everybody. He got loose. He must have monkeyed around. He must have monkeyed around with the buckles on his seat or whatever and found
yeah.
a way to get loose, right?
And so this has already become, this is already a dangerous situation,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And to add to the danger, Tim Flock had cut a trap door in the floorboard of the vehicle.
Yeah, which, can I mention?
Yeah.
Was common for that time period. That's something that I heard Richard Petty had done also. You
mm-hmm.
know, other drivers of that day had done it. Or not Richard, maybe it was his father. But anyways, it was common to do that, and they put like a flap of maybe carpet over it.
Right.
And you would pull a string, and it would lift the flap.
So you could check on the tire.
Yeah, the right front tire, because
yeah.
that's the one that's getting, if you're making left-hand turns all day long.
That's the one that's getting punished.
The right front tire is the one that's going to go first on those cars. So they were constantly monitoring that tire, and the only way to do it was to cut that hole in there, the access hole, pull this flap, be able to just kind of tilt their head over and look at it, and then let the flap go, and they're back to racing.
And now we are going to dive briefly into just some biology about primates, about monkeys.
Okay.
Monkeys are intelligent, frighteningly intelligent in comparison to many other animals.
Mm-hmm.
So monkeys will have the ability to observe and imitate actions. So that's why you'll see trained monkeys. Now, we're not saying it's ethical, of course, but we're saying that it's important to know that monkeys and apes have this ability.
Yeah, sure. To mimic somebody is often called to ape the action, right?
Yes, exactly. And during their, they had a total of 8 races, I think, Flock and Flacco?
I think so.
During their previous seven races, Jocko had observed Flock's racing motions. So he had seen him, you know, steering. He had seen him shifting. He had seen him occasionally pulling the string of the chain to open the flap of the floorboard.
Yeah.
So they get, and now that he was free, he started doing some of those things.
Oh, boy.
And he pulled the chain, the flap went open, and a rock, the way the story goes at least, a rock popped up from the floorboard and boom, smacks Jocko Flacco.
Yep, right between the eyes.
Yes, square in his monkey face.
And the horrible thing about this is, now I'm sure that a lot of people thought we were going to mention that there was a wreck here, right? Yeah. The horrible thing about this is that he just started, I mean, it obviously injured him. He's screaming, you know, like his, you know, just screeching, I guess is a better way to say it. Loses his mind, goes nuts inside the cabin. Now, can you imagine all this is going on during the middle of the race?
Running in a blind, painful rage around
I mean, they're like, you know, topping 100 miles an hour. You know, he's trying not to lose control, but, he's, you know, darn near having that happen. And people see this happening. They see what's going on inside because they can see that something's not right and that the monkey is acting completely different than it did, you know, the last time around when it was waving and smiling. So
Tim wanted to kill that monkey, says West Coast stock car ace Herschel McGriff. It was running around the bench seat of that Hudson, climbing over the steering wheel. And then here comes our old buddy Richard Passwater, who'd won the race at Charlotte.
Yeah.
Earlier, he got a closer look at the shenanigans because he's also racing in this. I was behind Tim when old Jocko got loose, says Passwater. I could see the monkey running around like crazy. That monkey was wild. At one point, he jumped on Tim's back. It looked like old Jocko was going to choke him.
Oh, what? This is crazy. I cannot imagine.
This becomes a different sport.
It's totally different. I mean, I don't know how he managed to keep the car on the track at that point. I just don't understand it at all.
Right.
I mean,
and these were, you know, these are the era of NASCAR we're talking about. These cars are already fairly difficult to control.
They're a bit unwieldy. I mean, they're huge cars. They handle really well, of course, for their size and for, you know, the make and model they are. But still, you got to imagine that those things are like 2 tons, 2.5 tons of car, and they're not designed the way that cars are now. They don't handle quite as crisp.
Right.
There's a lot of different circumstances that would lead me to believe that I mean, honestly, I just don't know how Tim was able to keep the car on the track. So here's this kind of – this is a funny little line that's often quoted. you know, he says he reached up with his left hand and he kept his eyes on the track and the race, and he grabbed the monkey by the neck just to slow him down. And he said he slowed down as he went into turn four, down into pit road. And of course, there's no yellow flag or anything going on. So he's making just an unscheduled pit stop, right?
Yeah.
He goes down into pit road, holds the monkey out the window. The mechanic grabs him and, you know, not knowing what's going on, because I'm sure communication wasn't anything like what it is now. He's like, what's this? You know, but he hands him out to him. And it says that it was the only time known in history, in NASCAR history, that an official pit stop was made for a monkey to be put out of the car.
Yeah.
And you see that often and here and there, you know, that's like the way that people draw you into the story, you know, like an official pit stop to hand a monkey out of the window. Funny to say the least, but you know, it ends up costing him
first place.
Cost him second place, I believe. And because he would have been in second place for the race.
Right, right.
And it cost him about $600 in his paycheck that day. And the end result, I guess, Ben, is that Jocko was immediately retired after that race. They said, you know, we can't do this anymore.
Thus endeth Jocko Flacco's brief but bright career as the only non-human, finger quotes, race car driver.
Yeah, that's right. And it was his last public appearance, really, because according to Tim, this is where the story goes two different ways.
Yeah.
Now the verdict, let's just get the verdict out of the way on this, on the legend. So the verdict was that, you know, this is NASCAR's winning monkey. We've mentioned this, that he's already won as many titles, et cetera.
Right.
The verdict is absolutely true. Of course, it happened. It really did happen. You could see lots of photos of Jocko Flacco and Tim Flock together.
He was in the car at least when Flock won.
Yeah, he was a co-driver, I guess you could say. Like much like the Goldfish would be the co-driver in the BMW entry.
All right, that's generous. Okay. I'll go with you.
Much like Mr. Wappet was Donald Campbell's co-driver.
Objection, Mr. Wappet was not living.
Okay.
All right, but whatever. Fair enough. Okay, so it's true in a cute way.
Here's where it branches out, right?
Yes.
What did Tim Flock say happened to Jocko at the end of his racing career?
Well, Tim Flock said that at the end of the racing career, he said, I had to retire Flacco. I couldn't teach him to sign his autograph, mm-hmm. so I had to get rid of him.
And that's a very nice tale.
That's very diplomatic, mm-hmm. and something nice to say to kids.
Yeah,
and then according to Tim Flock, Jocko retired and just lived with the family and didn't have to go in the races.
Yeah,
anymore.
He said he lived a life of leisure after that point. You know, this is him being interviewed later that, you know, it was a life of leisure. He just retired to the home with the family and everything was just great, right?
That's the story I want to believe.
That's a nice story. That's a nice ending. However, later when they talked to Tim's widow, because this is many years later.
Right.
Tim passed away.
Tim's widow, Frances Flock. Tim passed away in 1998.
Okay, 1998. So it's some time later, a long time later. But according to Tim's widow, I remember the blow that he suffered in the vehicle there. Right,
the rock that hit him.
The rock right into the head. She said that apparently Jocko had suffered some sort of brain injury from that accident and never quite recovered after that.
He was listless.
Yeah, he didn't eat or anything like that. They took him to the vet because they were trying, you know, it's the family pet. They're mm-hmm. trying to take care of this animal. They take him to the vet. The vet says, it doesn't look good for Jocko. I think that the best thing to do at this point, you know, because quality of life would be just to have him put down. And that's what they did, according to his widow. So that's an unhappy ending.
Yeah.
Short,
two different
versions. It's an abrupt ending, I guess, to the life of Jocko Flacco, but like you said, I would prefer to I'd prefer Tim's version of this, that he just retired a life of leisure and lived out the rest of his days in the backyard of some Atlanta home.
And even again, with such incredibly intelligent creatures, they are fully capable of having depression.
Oh,
it doesn't
sure.
necessarily indicate brain damage. I think there are questions that still remain about the. About the story of Jocko Flacco, mm-hmm. but we have verified that this legend is true with an asterisk, I'm going to say. Asterisk.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to say it. That, you know, he's a co-driver, didn't really, you know, handle the wheel other than maybe inadvertently when he went
nuts. That one time.
when he went nuts, after being struck by the rock, I think mm-hmm. I would have gone crazy too. But, I guess that's probably the best way to put it, is that it's true with an asterisk.
The moral of our story today, ladies and gentlemen, is that one should not race with monkeys. You can hang out with them. You can have, you know, you can have wonderful times, but maybe you shouldn't compete in NASCAR.
That is sage advice, Ben.
Thank you.
One should not race with monkeys.
It's classy because we said one instead of you.
That's right. I think so. You know, and just to kind of put a cap on this.
Yeah.
Tim was actually, he's a very successful driver, actually. His career ended when this is not good, I guess. His career ended prematurely when he and Curtis Turner, who I mentioned earlier, that was right. I wanted to mention his name, they were blackballed by the Bill France family from all of NASCAR competition for trying to start a driver's union. Mm-hmm. So that was the end of Curtis Turner and of Tim Flock. So it wasn't anything terribly tragic that happened on the course or anything.
Just fighting the man.
Exactly. And, one thing is that according to this article, and I'll have to dig into the NASCAR records, but it looks like Tim Flock won 40 of 189 races, which is even now a record for a winning percentage that even today, you know, it remains unmatched. It says that, to win 40 out of 189, that's an incredible percentage.
That is an incredible
percentage.
That's
way high. I mean, it's almost like, you know, when someone has like one of these, he had a long career. He raced years and years and years, but it's almost like, you know, in baseball or something, mm-hmm. when someone bats one time, you know, they get a base hit or something, you know, it's like they're batting 1,000. It's like, well, you know, here's a rookie that's batting 1,000. Well, they've only been to bat once.
Yeah. Percentage and ratio, those can be tricky records.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like if you had a short career and this was like you won one out of two races that you competed in, that would be something different. But out of 189 races to win 40,
yeah,
that's pretty amazing. That's a good record.
And while we've got everybody's attention still, if you wrote an email to us, oh my gosh, excuse me, then please get excited because we're going to do some listener mail.
Is it yours?
Right. All right, Scott, Here we go. Corey writes into us and says, "Hey guys, longtime listener, first time writer. I listen to your podcast about out of control vehicles. I've got a story for you." And he sent us this photograph that I'm handing you now.
I remember this now.
So Corey says, "I have a 67 Camaro project car that I have been messing with for 20 odd years. One day I was driving down a side street and the steering wheel came off in my hands. I was doing about 25 mph. I have to say I drew a complete blank on what to do." I can't blame him.
You know,
we didn't talk about what to do if your steering wheel falls off.
That's completely out of control. I agree.
Yeah. "I knew that my car brakes to the right, so I waited until my right side was clear and then braked hard to steer between parked cars. By the time I stopped, I was on the other side of the sidewalk and completely in someone's yard, missing a tree by about 2 feet.
Okay.
There was no damage to the car. And that's lucky because that's a handsome vehicle. And all I needed to fix was a sprinkler head in the person's yard. Basically, I was completely lucky that there was a large enough gap between parked cars and no one on the sidewalk."
Okay, two things, Ben.
Two things.
This car is beautiful, by the way. You sent a photo of it. It's astounding. It's
great,
very, very nice.
Corey.
Beautiful
great
piece of work. And second, what a cool head, huh? To be able to have a steering wheel pop off
just
your
sort
hands.
Of, boop.
And I could see that happening in an older car. This one, by the way, looks like a show car. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But to have it pop off in your hands and then to have the clear head to say, my car veers to the right when I brake, so I know that I'm going to have to wait until it's clear on the right to try to brake.
Uh-huh.
Amazing. And to be able to do it between two parked cars and to not hit anything, that's a good story.
Yeah, I think that I'm one of those people who tends to believe that luck is a combination of preparation and opportunity, maybe, mm-hmm. but also clarity, the mm-hmm. ability to make a clear-headed decision.
Yep. Did not panic,
which is tremendously impressive. Thank you so much for writing to us, Corey. Thank you for sending such a wonderful picture of your vehicle. For anyone else who thinks their steering wheel might pop off mid-drive, go ahead and figure out which side of the road your car is going to brake toward.
Take some notes from Corey because I don't know if I would have such a clear head at that point.
Yeah.
I'd try to, but man, that's a lot of focus.
Yes, thank God there wasn't a monkey in the car.
Yeah, that would be the only other thing that would distract him. Well, whatever.
And I knew my monkey would jump to the left, but the car brakes to the right. Well, if we were just making monkey jokes at this point, we should probably head out. The legend is true-ish, and we're so glad that you guys checked out our episode. Let us know what you think about this episode, what you think about out-of-control cars. Let us know if there's another car story that you would like to hear.
Yeah, maybe we should continue on with some more of these myths and legends and see where that takes us. Because these are interesting stories to be
had.
So I think there's a wealth of information in this book. I think we should maybe dig deeper.
Mm-hmm. And you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. We set this podcast out about twice a week, but every day we're updating those with some new, interesting, weird stories. And if you have a suggestion for something you'd like to hear, we're always around. Just send us an email.
At carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.